Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do some Saki, Hector, Hume, and Roe, the complete stories. We'll probably do three or four of them, not too long. Let's pick up where we left off. Hermann the Irascible, a story of the great weep. Hermann the Irascible, a story of the great weep. It was in the second decade of the 20th century, after the great plague had devastated England, that Hermann the Irascible, nicknamed also the Wise, sat on the British throne. The mortal sickness had swept away the entire royal family under the third and fourth generations, and thus it came to pass that Hermann the 14th of Saxe-Drachsen-Wachtelstein, who had stood 30th in the order of succession, found himself one day ruler of the British dominions within and beyond the seas. He was one of the unexpected things that happen in politics, and he happened with a great thoroughness. In many ways, he was the most progressive monarch who had sat on an important throne. Before people knew where they were somewhere else. Even his ministers, progressive though they were by tradition, found it difficult to keep pace with his legislative suggestions. As a matter of fact, admitted the prime minister, we are hampered by these votes for women creatures. They disturb our meetings throughout the country, and they try to turn Downing Street into a sort of political picnic ground. They must be dealt with, said Hermann. Dealt with, said the Prime Minister. Exactly, just so. But how? I will draft you a bill, said the King, sitting down at his typewriting machine, enacting that women shall vote at all future elections. Shall vote, you observe, or, to put it plainer, must. Voting will remain optional, as before, for male electors, but every woman between the ages of 21 and 70 will be obliged to vote. Not only at elections for parliament, county councils, district boards, parish councils, and municipalities, but for coroners, school inspectors, church wardens, curators of museums, sanitary authorities, police court interpreters, swimming bath instructors, contractors, choir masters, market superintendents, art school teachers, cathedral vergers, and other local functionaries whose names I will add as they occur to me. All these offices will become elective, and failure to vote at any election falling within her area of residence will involve the female elector in a penalty of £10. Absence, unsupported by an adequate medical certificate, will not be accepted as an excuse. Pass this bill through the House, through the two Houses of Parliament, and bring it to me for signature the day after tomorrow. From the very outset, the compulsory female franchise, CFF, produced little or no elation, even in circles which had been loudest in demanding the vote. Produced little or no elation. So this was a current issue back then, women getting the vote, and a lot of whining about it. The bulk of the women of the country had been indifferent or hostile to the franchise agitation, and the most fanatical suffragettes began to wonder what they had found so attractive in the prospect of putting ballot papers into a box. In the country districts, the task of carrying out the provisions of the new act was irksome enough. In the towns and cities, it became an incubus. There seemed no end to the elections. Laundresses and seamstresses had to hurry away from their work to vote, often for a candidate whose name they hadn't heard before and whom they selected at haphazard. Female clerks and waitresses got up extra early to get their voting done before starting off to their places of business. Society women found their arrangements impeded and upset by the continual necessity for attending the polling stations, and weekend parties and summer holidays became gradually a masculine luxury. As for Cairo and the Riviera, they were possible only for genuine invalids or people of enormous wealth, for the accumulation of $10 fines during a prolonged absence was a contingency that even ordinarily wealthy folk could hardly afford to risk. It was not wonderful that the female disfranchisement agitation became a formidable movement. There's a very unusual use of the word wonderful. It was not wonderful. It was not, he means in the sense of surprising, that the female disfranchisement agitation became a formidable movement. The No Votes for Women League numbered in its female numbered its female adherents by a million. Its colors, citron and old Dutch matter, became a popular refrain, or were flaunted everywhere, and its battle hymn, "We Don't Want to Vote," became a popular refrain. As the government showed no signs of being impressed by a peaceful persuasion, more violent methods came into vogue. Meetings were disturbed, ministers were mobbed, policemen were bitten, and ordinary prison fare rejected. And on the eve of the anniversary of Trafalgar, women bound themselves up in tears, up the entire length of the Nelson Column, so that its customary floral decoration had to be abandoned. Still, the government obstinately adhered to its conviction that women ought to have the vote. Then, as a last resort, some woman wit, hit upon an expedient which it was strange that no one had thought of before. The Great Weep was organized. The Great Weep. Relays of women, 10,000 at a time, wept continuously in the public places of the metropolis. They wept in railway stations, in tubes and omnibuses, in the National Gallery, at the Army and Navy stores, in St. James Park, at ballad concerts, at Prince's, and in the Burlington Arcade. The hitherto unbroken success of the brilliant farcical comedy Henry's Rabbit was imperiled by the presence of drearily weeping women in stalls and circle and gallery, and one of the brightest divorce cases that had been tried for many years was robbed of much of its sparkle by the lachrymose behavior of a section of the audience. "What are we to do?" asked the Prime Minister, whose cook had wept into all the breakfast dishes and whose nursemaid had gone out, crying quietly and miserably, to take the children for a walk in the park. "There is a time for everything," said the king. "There is a time to yield. Pass a measure through the two houses, depriving women of the right to vote, and bring it to me for the royal assent the day after tomorrow." As the minister withdrew, Herman the Irascible, who was also nicknamed the Wise, gave a profound chuckle. "There are more ways of killing a cat than by choking it with cream," he quoted. "But I'm not sure," he added, "that it's not the best way." You want to vote? Vote often. Vote always. That will cure you of the itch. Next story, the unrest cure. On the rack in the railway carriage immediately opposite Clovis, and remember we're in the Clovis section of the collected stories, was a solidly wrought traveling bag with a carefully written label on which was inscribed J.P. Huddle, The Warren, Tilfield, near Slowborough. Immediately below the rack sat the human embodiment of the label, a solid, sedate individual, sedately dressed, sedately conversational. Even without his conversation, which was addressed to a friend seated by his side and touched chiefly on such topics as the backwardness of Roman hyacinths and the prevalence of measles at the rectory, one could have gauged fairly accurately the temperament and mental outlook of the traveling bag's owner. But he seemed unwilling to leave anything to the imagination of a casual observer, and his talk grew presently personal and introspective. "I don't know how it is," he told his friend. "I'm not much over 40, but I seem to have settled down into a deep groove of elderly middle age. My sister shows the same tendency. We like everything to be exactly in its accustomed place. We like things to happen exactly at their appointed times. We like everything to be the usual, orderly, punctual, methodical, to a hair's breadth, to a minute. It distresses and upsets us if it is not so. For instance, to take a very trifling matter, a thrush has built its nest year after year in the catkin tree on the lawn. This year, for no obvious reason, it is building it in the ivy on the garden wall. We have said very little about it, but I think we both feel that the change is unnecessary and just a little irritating." "Perhaps," said a friend, "it is a different thrush." "We have suspected that," said J.P. Huddle, "and I think it gives us even more cause for annoyance. We don't feel that we want a change of thrush in our time of life, and yet, as I have said, we have scarcely reached an age at which these things should make themselves seriously felt. What you want, said the friend, is an unrest cure. An unrest cure? I've never heard of such a thing. You've heard of rest cures for people who've broken down under the stress of too much worry and strenuous living. Well, you're suffering from overmuch repose and placidity, and you need the opposite of such a treatment. But where would one go for such a thing? Well, you might stand as an Orange candidate for Kilkenny, that's reference to the Irish Troubles. I assume he means a Protestant in a Catholic area. Or do a course of district visiting in one of the Apache quarters of Paris. Or give lectures in Berlin to prove that most of Wagner's music was written by Gambetta. And there's always the interior of Morocco to travel in. But to be really effective, the unrest cure ought to be tried in the home. How you would do it, I haven't the faintest idea. It was at this point in the conversation that Clovis became galvanized into alert attention. After all, his 2 days' visit to an elderly relative at Slowborough did not promise much excitement. Before the train had stopped, he had decorated his sinister shirt cuff with the inscription, J.P. Huddle, The Warren, Tilfield, near Slowborough. 2 mornings later, Mr. Huddle broke in on his sister's privacy as he sat as she sat reading Country Life in the morning room. It was her day and hour and place for reading Country Life, and the intrusion was absolutely irregular, but he bore in his hand a telegram, and in that household telegrams were recognized as happening by the hand of God. This particular telegram partook of the nature of a thunderbolt. Bishop examining confirmation class in neighborhood unable to say rectory on account measles invokes your hospitality, sending secretary arrange. I scarcely know the bishop. I've only spoken to him once, exclaimed J.P. Huddle, with the exculpating air of one who realizes too late the indiscretion of speaking to strange bishops. Miss Huddle was the first to rally. She disliked thunderbolts as fervently as her brother did, but the womanly instinct in her told her that thunderbolts must be fed. We can curry the cold duck, she said. It was not the appointed day for curry, but the little orange envelope involved a certain departure from rule and custom. Her brother said nothing, but his eyes thanked her for being brave. A young gentleman to see you, announced the parlor maid. The secretary, murmured the Huddles in unison. They instantly stiffened into a demeanor which proclaimed that, though they held all strangers to be guilty, they were willing to hear anything they might have to say in their defense. The young gentleman who came into the room with a certain elegant haughtiness was not at all Huddle's idea of a bishop's secretary. He had not supposed that the Episcopal establishment could have afforded such an expensively upholstered article when there were so many other claims in its resources. The face was fleetingly familiar. If he had bestowed more attention on the fellow traveler sitting opposite him in the railway carriage 2 days before, he might have recognized Clovis in his present visitor. So Clovis is up to one of his tricks again. You are the bishop's secretary, asked Huddle, becoming consciously deferential. His confidential secretary, answered Clovis. You may call me Stanislaus. My other name doesn't much matter. The bishop and Colonel Alberti may be here to lunch. I shall be here in any case. It sounded rather like the program of a royal visit. The bishop is examining a confirmation class in the neighborhood, isn't he? Asked Mrs. Huddle. Ostensibly, was the dark reply, followed by a request for a large-scale map of the locality. Clovis was still immersed in a seemingly profound study of the map when another telegram arrived. It was addressed to Prince Stanislaus, care of Huddle, the Warren, etc. Clovis glanced at the contents and announced, The bishop and Alberti won't be here till late in the afternoon. Then he returned to his scrutiny of the map. The luncheon was not a very festive function. The princely secretary ate and drank with fair appetite, but severely discouraged conversation. At the finish of the meal, he broke suddenly into a radiant smile, thanked his hostess for a charming repast, and kissed her hand with deferential rapture. Miss Huddle was unable to decide in her mind whether the action savored of Louis XIV's courtliness or the reprehensible Roman attitude toward the Sabine women, whether she was being treated with great respect or raped. It was not her day for having a headache, but she felt that the circumstance excused her and retired to her room to have as much headache as was possible before the bishop's arrival. Clovis, having asked the way to the nearest telegraph office, disappeared presently down the carriage drive. Mr. Huddle met him in the hall some 2 hours later and asked when the bishop would arrive. "He is in the library with Alberti," was the reply. "But why wasn't I told? I never knew he had come," exclaimed Huddle. "No one knows he is here," said Clovis. "The quieter we can keep matters, the better. And on no account disturb him in the library. Those are his orders. But what is all this mystery about? And who is Alberti? And isn't the bishop going to have tea?" "The bishop is out for blood, not tea." "Blood," gasped Huddle, who did not find that the thunderbolt improved on acquaintance. "Tonight is going to be a great night in the history of Christendom," said Clovis. "We are going to massacre every Jew in the neighborhood." "To massacre the Jews?" said Huddle indignantly. "Do you mean to tell me that there's a general rising against them?" "No, it's the bishop's own idea. He's in there arranging all the details now." "But the bishop is such a tolerant, humane man." "That is precisely what will heighten the effect of his action. The sensation will be enormous." That at least Huddle could believe. "He will be hanged," he said with conviction. "A motor is waiting to carry him to the coast, where a steam yacht is in readiness." "But there aren't 30 Jews in the whole neighborhood," protested Huddle, whose brain, under the repeated shocks of the day, was operating with the uncertainty of a telegraph wire during earthquake disturbances. "We have 26 in our list," said Clovis, referring to a bundle of notes. "We shall be able to deal with them all the more thoroughly." "Do you mean to tell me that you are meditating violence against a man like Sir Leon Burberry?" stammered Huddle. "He's one of the most respected men in the country." "He's down on our list," said careless Clovisly. "After all, we've got men we can trust to do our job, so we shan't have to rely on local assistance. And we've got some Boy Scouts helping us as auxiliaries." "Boy Scouts?" "Yes, when they understood there was real killing to be done, they were even keener than the men. This thing will be a blot on the 20th century." "And your house will be the blotting pad. Have you realized that half the papers of Europe and the United States will publish pictures of him? By the way, I've sent some photographs of you and your sister that I found in the library to the Martin and Devoca. I hope you don't mind." Those are like French Morning and the Week papers. "Also a sketch of the staircase. Most of the killing will probably be done in the staircase." The emotions that were surging in J.P. Huddle's brain were almost too intense to be disclosed in speech, but he managed to gasp out, "There aren't any Jews in this house." "Not at present," said Clovis. "I shall go to the police," shouted Huddle with sudden energy. "In the shrubbery," said Clovis, "are posed 10 men who have orders to fire on anyone who leaves the house without my signal of permission. Another armed piquet is in ambush near the front gate. The Boy Scouts watch the back premises." At this moment, the cheerful hoot of a motor horn was heard from the drive. Huddle rushed to the hall door with the feeling of a man half awakened from a nightmare and beheld Sir Leon Burberry, who had driven himself over in his car. "I got your telegram," he said. "What's up?" "Telegram? It seemed to be a day of telegrams. Come here at once. Urgent. James Huddle," was the purport of the message displayed before Huddle's bewildered eyes. "I see it all," he exclaimed suddenly in a voice shaken with agitation, and with a look of agony in the direction of the shrubbery, he hauled the astonished Burberry into the house. Tea had just been laid in the hall, but the now thoroughly panic-stricken Huddle dragged his protesting guest upstairs, and in a few minutes' time, the entire household had been summoned to that region of momentary safety. Clovis alone graced the tea table with his presence. The fanatics in the library were evidently too immersed in their monstrous machinations to dally with the solace of teacup and hot toast. Once the youth rose, in answer to the summons of the front doorbell, and admitted Mr. Paul Isaacs, shoemaker and parish counselor, who had also received a pressing invitation to the Warren. With an atrocious assumption of courtesy, which a Borgia could hardly have outdone, the secretary escorted the new captive of his net to the head of the stairway where his involuntary host awaited him. And then ensued a long, ghastly vigil of watching and waiting. Once or twice, Clovis left the house to stroll across to the shrubbery, returning always to the library, for the purpose, evidently, of making a brief report. Once he took in the letters from the evening postman and brought them to the top of the stairs with punctilious politeness. After his next absence, he came halfway up the stairs to make an announcement. "The Boy Scouts mistook my signal and have killed the postman. I've had very little practice in this sort of thing, you know. Another time I shall do better." The housemaid, who was engaged to be married to the evening postman, gave way to clamorous grief. "Remember that your mistress has a headache," said J.P. Huddle. Miss Huddle's headache was worse. Clovis hastened downstairs and, after a short visit to the library, returned with another message. "The bishop is sorry to hear that Miss Huddle has a headache. He is issuing orders that, as far as possible, no firearm shall be used near the house. Any killing that is necessary on the premises will be done with cold steel. The bishop does not see why a man should not be a gentleman as well as a Christian." That was the last they saw of Clovis. It was nearly 7 o'clock, and his elderly relative liked him to dress for dinner. But though he had left them forever, the lurking suggestion of his presence haunted the lower regions of the house during the long hours of the wakeful night, and every creak of the stairway, every rustle of wind through the shrubbery was fraught with horrible meaning. At about 7 next morning, the gardener's boy and the early postman finally convinced the watchers that the 20th century was still unblotted. "I don't suppose," mused Clovis, as an early train bore him townwards, "that they will be in the least grateful for the unrest cure." Next story is The Jesting of Arlington Stringham. Arlington Stringham made a joke in the House of Commons. It was a thin house and a very thin joke, something about the Anglo-Saxon race having a great many angles. It is possible that it was unintentional, but a fellow member, who did not wish it to be supposed that he was asleep because his eyes were shut, laughed. One or two of the papers noted a laugh, in brackets, and another, which was notorious for the carelessness of its political news, mentioned laughter. Things often begin in that way. "Arlington made a joke in the house last night," said Eleanor Stringham to her mother. "In all the years we've been married, neither of us has made jokes, and I don't like it now. I'm afraid it's the beginning of the rift in the lute." "What lute?" said her mother. "It's a quotation," said Eleanor. To say that anything was a quotation was an excellent method, in Eleanor's eyes, for withdrawing it from discussion, just as you could always defend indifferent lamb late in the season by saying, "It's mutton." And, of course, Arlington Stringham continued to tread the thorny path of conscious humor into which fate had beckoned him. "The country's looking very green, but, after all, that's what it's there for," he remarked to his wife 2 days later. "That's very modern, and I dare say very clever, but I'm afraid it's wasted on me," she observed coldly. If she had known how much effort it had cost him to make the remark, she might have greeted it in a kinder spirit. It is the tragedy of human endeavor that it works so often unseen and unguessed. Arlington said nothing, not from injured pride, but because he was thinking hard for something to say. Eleanor mistook his silence for an assumption of tolerant superiority, and her anger prompted her to a further jibe. "You'd better tell it to Lady Isabel. I've no doubt she would approve it. She would appreciate it." Lady Isabel was seen everywhere with a fawn-colored collie at a time when everyone kept nothing but Pekingese, and she had once eaten 4 green apples at an afternoon tea in the botanical gardens, so she was widely credited with a rather unpleasant wit. The Censoria said she slept in a hammock and understood Yeats's poems, a nice little dig, but her family denied both stories. "The rift is widening to an abyss," said Elmore to her mother that afternoon. "I should not tell that to anyone," remarked her mother after long reflection. "Naturally, I should not talk about it very much," said Elmore, "but why should I mention it to anyone?" "Because you can't have an abyss in a lute. There isn't room." Eleanor's outlook on life did not improve as the afternoon wore on. The page boy had brought from the library by Mere and Wald, instead of by mere chance, the book which everyone denied having read. The unwelcome substitute appeared to be a collection of nature notes contributed by the author to the pages of some northern weekly, and when one had been prepared to plunge with disapproving mind into a regrettable chronicle of ill-spent lives, it was intensely irritating to read, "The dainty yellowhammers are now with us and flaunt their jaundiced livery from every bush and hillock." Besides, the thing was so obviously untrue. Either there must be hardly any bushes or hillocks in these parts, or the country must be fearfully overstocked with yellowhammers. The thing scarcely seemed worth telling such a lie about. And the page boy stood there, with sleekly brushed and parted hair, and his air of chaste and callous indifference to the desires and passions of the world. Eleanor hated boys, and she would have liked to have whipped this one long and often. It was perhaps the yearning of a woman who had no children of her own. She turned at random to another paragraph. Lie quietly concealed in the fern and bramble in the gap by the old rowan tree, and you may see, almost every evening during the early summer, a pair of lesser whitethroats creeping up and down the nettles and hedge growth that mask their nesting place. The insufferable monotony of the proposed recreation. Eleanor would not have watched the most brilliant performance at His Majesty's Theater for a single evening under such uncomfortable circumstances, and to be asked to watch lesser whitethroats creeping up and down a nettle almost every evening during the height of the season struck her as an imputation on her intelligence that was positively offensive. Impatiently, she transferred her attention to the dinner menu, which the boy had thoughtfully brought in as an alternative to the more solid literary fare. Rabbit curry met her eye, and the lines of disapproval deepened on her already puckered brow. The cook was a great believer in the influence of environment, and nourished an obstinate conviction that if you brought rabbit and curry powder together in one dish, a rabbit curry would be the result. And Clovis and the odious Bertie Van Tahn were coming to dinner. Surely, thought Eleanor, if Arlington knew how much he had that day to try her, he would refrain from joke-making. Getting into the mentality of the English rich here. At dinner that night, it was Eleanor herself who mentioned the name of a certain statesman who may be decently covered under the disguise of X. X, said Arlington Stringham, has the soul of a meringue. It was a useful remark to have on hand because it applied equally well to four prominent statesmen of the day, which quadrupled the opportunities for using it. Meringues haven't got souls, said Eleanor's mother. It's a mercy that they haven't, said Clovis. They would be always losing them, and people like my aunt would get up missions to meringues and say it was wonderful how much one could teach them and how much more one could learn from them. What could you learn from a meringue? Asked Eleanor's mother. My aunt has been known to learn humility from an ex-viceroy, said Clovis. I wish cook would learn to make curry or have the sense to leave it alone, said Arlington suddenly and savagely. Eleanor's face softened. It was like one of his old remarks in the days when there was no abyss between them. It was during the debate on the Foreign Office vote that Stringham had made his great remark that the people of Crete, unfortunately, make more history than they can consume locally. It was not brilliant, but it came in the middle of a dull speech, and the House was quite pleased with it. Old gentlemen with bad memories said it reminded them of Disraeli, and that is indeed a quote from someone, I don't remember who, and I'm not sure it was Crete. It might have been somewhere else. It was Eleanor's friend, Gertrude Upton, who drew her attention to Arlington's newest outbreak. Eleanor in these days avoided the morning papers. It's very modern, and I suppose very clever, she observed. Of course it's clever, said Gertrude. All Lady Isabel's sayings are clever, and luckily they bear repeating. Are you sure it's one of her sayings? Said Eleanor. My dear, I've heard her say it dozens of times. So that is where he gets his humor, said Eleanor slowly, and the hard lines deepened round her mouth. The death of Eleanor Stringham from an overdose of chloral, occurring at the end of a rather uneventful season, excited a certain amount of unobtrusive speculation. Clovis, who perhaps exaggerated the importance of curry in the home, hinted at domestic sorrow. And of course, Arlington never knew. It was the tragedy of his life that he should miss the fullest effect of his jesting. Now we'll come to maybe the second most, and this will be the last for today, but the second most or best known story after Tormor might be Shredni Vashtar. I suppose it might be pronounced like Sri Racha. Shredni Vashtar. Conradin was 10 years old. Conrad, I-N. Conradin was 10 years old. And the doctor had pronounced his professional opinion that the boy would not live another 5 years. The doctor was silky and effete and counted for very little, but his opinion was endorsed by Mrs. DeRop, who counted for nearly everything. Mrs. de Rapp was Conradin's cousin and guardian, and in his eyes, she represented those three-fifths of the world that are necessary and disagreeable and real. The other two-fifths, in perpetual antagonism to the foregoing, were summed up in himself and his imagination. One of these days, Conradin supposed he would succumb to the mastering pressure of wearisome necessary things, such as illnesses and coddling restrictions and drawn-out dullness. Without his imagination, which was rampant under the spur of loneliness, he would have succumbed long ago. Mrs. de Rapp would never, in her honest moments, have confessed to herself that she disliked Conradin, though she might have been dimly aware that thwarting him, quote, for his good, was a duty which she did not find particularly irksome. This is a big Anglo-Saxon feature, doing things for your own good. Doing good for your own good, the demoralizing. Conradin, so he's observing that she can't admit to herself she enjoys doing things to thwart him. But she wouldn't go so far as saying she didn't like him, because that would reflect badly on her and what she thinks of herself. Conradin hated her with a desperate sincerity which he was perfectly able to mask. Such few pleasures as he could contrive for himself gained an added relish from the likelihood that they would be displeasing to his guardian, and from the realm of his imagination she was locked out, an unclean thing which should find no entrance. In the dull, cheerless garden, overlooked by so many windows that were ready to open with a message not to do this or that, or a reminder that medicines were due, he found little attraction. She'd be screaming at him from the windows if he went in the garden. The few fruit trees it contained were set jealously apart from his plucking, as though they were rare specimens of their kind, blooming in an arid waste. It would probably have been difficult to find a market gardener who would have offered 10 shillings for their entire yearly produce. In a forgotten corner, however, almost behind a dismal shrubbery, was a disused tool shed of respectable proportions, and within its walls Conradin found a haven, something that took on the varying aspects of a playroom and a cathedral. He had peopled it with a legion of familiar phantoms, evoked partly from fragments of history and partly from his own brain, but it also boasted two inmates of flesh and blood. In one corner lived a ragged-plumaged Houdan hen, on which the boy lavished an affection that had scarcely another outlet. Further back in the gloom stood a large hutch, divided into two compartments, one of which was fronted with close iron bars. This was the abode of a large polecat ferret, which a friendly butcher boy had once smuggled, cage and all, into its present quarters, in exchange for a long-secreted hoard of small silver. Conradin was dreadfully aware of the lithe, sharp-fanged beast, but it was his most treasured possession. Its very presence in the tool shed was a secret and fearful joy, to be kept scrupulously from the knowledge of the woman, capital W, as he privately dubbed his cousin. And one day, out of heaven knows what material, he spun the beast a wonderful name, and from that moment it grew into a god and a religion. The woman indulged in religion once a week at a church nearby and took Conradin with her, but to him, the church service was an alien rite in the house of Rimmon. Every Thursday, in the dim and musty silence of the tool shed, he worshipped with mystic and elaborate ceremonial before the wooden hutch where dwelt Shredni Vashtar, the great ferret. Red flowers in their season and scarlet berries in the wintertime were offered at his shrine, for he was a god who laid some special stress on the fierce, impatient side of things, as opposed to the woman's religion, which, as far as Conradin could observe, went to great lengths in the contrary direction. Nice, weak, soft, you see? Maybe there's something about civilization in what he's saying. And on great festivals, powdered nutmeg was strewn in front of his hutch, an important feature of the offering being that the nutmeg had to be stolen. These festivals were of irregular occurrence and were chiefly appointed to celebrate some passing event. On one occasion, when Mrs. de Rapp suffered from acute toothache for 3 days, Conradin kept up the festival during the entire 3 days and almost succeeded in persuading himself that Shredni Vashtar was personally responsible for the toothache. If the malady had lasted for another day, the supply of nutmeg would have given out. The Houdan hen was never drawn into the cult of Shredni Vashtar. Conradin had long ago settled that she was an Anabaptist, or she knew she'd be eaten by it. He did not pretend to have the remotest knowledge as to what an Anabaptist was, but he privately hoped that it was dashing and not very respectable. Anabaptist is actually the collective name for Mennonites and Amish, and they used to be quite sexually wild, some of them, in the very early days, but later they became more sedate, or other branches of them became more sedate. Mrs. Durop was the ground plan on which he based and detested all respectability. After a while, Conradin's absorption in the tool shed began to attract the notice of his guardian. "It's not good for him to be puttering down there in all weathers," she promptly decided, and at breakfast one morning, she announced that the Houdan hen had been sold and taken away overnight. With her short-sighted eyes, she peered at Conradin, waiting for an outbreak of rage and sorrow, which she was ready to rebuke with a flow of excellent precepts and reasoning. She's doing it for his own good. But Conradin said nothing. There was nothing to be said. Something perhaps in his white, set face gave her a momentary qualm, for at tea that afternoon there was a toast on the table, a delicacy which she usually banned on the ground that it was bad for him. She does what she wants and then claims it's for his benefit, and this is very characteristic of Anglo people. Also because the making of it gave trouble, a deadly offense in the middle-class feminine eye. "I thought you liked toast," she exclaimed with an injured air, observing that he did not touch it. "Sometimes," said Conradin. In the shed that evening, there was an innovation in the worship of the hutch god. Conradin had been wont to chant his praises. Tonight, he asked a boon. "Do one thing for me, Shredni Vashtar." The thing was not specified. As Shredni Vashtar was a god, he must be supposed to know. And, choking back a sob as he looked at that other empty corner, Conradin went back to the world he so hated. And every night in the welcome darkness of his bedroom, and every evening in the dusk of the tool shed, Conradin's bitter litany went up. "Do one thing for me, Shredni Vashtar." Mrs. Durop noticed that the visits to the shed did not cease, and one day she made a further journey of inspection. "What are you keeping in that locked hutch?" she asked. "I believe it's a guinea pig's. I'll have them all cleared away." Conradin shut his lips tight, but the woman ransacked his bedroom till she found the carefully hidden key, and forthwith marched down to the shed to complete her discovery. It was a cold afternoon, and Conradin had been bidden to keep to the house. From the furthest window of the dining room, the door of the shed could just be seen beyond the corner of the shrubbery, and there Conradin stationed himself. He saw the woman enter, and then he imagined her opening the door of the sacred hutch and peering down with her short-sighted eyes into the thick straw bed where the god lay hidden. Perhaps she would prod at the straw in her clumsy impatience. And Conradin fervently breathed his prayer for the last time. But he knew as he prayed that he did not believe. He knew that the woman would come out presently with that pursed smile he loathed so well in her face. And in an hour or two, the gardener would carry away his wonderful god, a god no longer, but a simple brown ferret in a hutch. And he knew that the woman would triumph always, as she triumphed now, and that he would grow ever more sickly under her pestering and domineering and superior wisdom, till one day nothing would matter much more with him, and the doctor would be proved right. He would die. And in the sting and misery of his defeat, he began to chant loudly and defiantly the hymn of his threatened idol. Shredni Vashtar went forth. His thoughts were red thoughts, and his teeth were white. His enemies called for peace, but he brought them death. Shredni Vashtar the Beautiful. And then of a sudden he stopped his chanting and drew closer to the window pane. The door of the shed still stood ajar as it had been left, and the minutes were slipping by. They were long minutes, but they slipped by nevertheless. He watched the starlings running and flying in little parties across the lawn. He counted them over and over again, with one eye always on that swinging door. A sour-faced maid came in to lay the table for tea, and still Conradin stood and waited and watched. Hope had crept by inches into his heart, and now a look of triumph began to blaze in his eye that had only known wistful patience of defeat. Under his breath, with a furtive exultation, he began once again the paean of victory and devastation. And presently his eyes were rewarded. Out through the doorway came a long, low, yellow and brown beast, with eyes ablink at the waning daylight, and dark, wet stains around the fur of its jaws and throat. Conradin dropped on his knees. The great polecat ferret made its way down to a small brook at the foot of the garden, drank for a moment, then crossed a little plank bridge, and was lost to sight in the bushes. Such was the passing of Shredni Vashtar. "Tea is ready," said the sour-faced maid. "Where's the mistress?" "She went down to the shed some time ago," said Conradin. And while the maid went to summon her mistress to tea, Conradin fished a toasting fork out of the sideboard drawer and proceeded to toast himself a piece of bread. And during the toasting of it and the buttering of it, with much butter and the slow enjoyment of eating it, Conradin listened to the noises and silences which fell in quick spasms beyond the dining room door. The loud, foolish screaming of the maid, the answering chorus of wondering ejaculations from the kitchen region, the scuttering footsteps and hurried embassies for outside help, and then, after a lull, the scared sobbings and the shuffling tread of those who bore a heavy burden into the house. "Whoever will break to the poor child? I couldn't do it for the life of me," exclaimed a shrill voice, and while they debated the matter among themselves, Conradin made himself another piece of toast. And that is the effect. Women are the, if you want to call women civilization, A, you're wrong, but B, if you do, yet there's something under it that's better, that even a child can see. And I'm not going to add any more commentary to that, which is a wonderful story, except that people have more than once mocked me when I used ejaculations in a non-sexual context. Well, that may be the only place you have seen it, but it isn't inherently a sexual thing. Answering chorus of wondering ejaculate, it just means something. The jack part is thrown. Adjective comes from the same thing, thrown off, thrown toward. You can obviously see the sexual meaning, but it also can mean just something you quickly say, spurt out of your mouth. Anyway, that's some wonderful stuff from Saki, that last Shredni Vashtar, probably his second most famous. Maybe we'll come to other ones that I remember more than Tobermory the Talking Cat is probably number one. Shredni Vashtar is probably two. But these are pictures of how England was maybe around 1900, 1910, in that period before the World War, kind of things that were going on and people were thinking about. It's just close enough to our modern time that we see some of it. And it's our own race and type. So we see their mentality of the women in particular, even probably more than the men. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again for more from Hector Humanroe, or Saki, real soon.